We still talk in terms of conquest. We still haven't become mature enough to think of ourselves as only a tiny part of a vast and incredible universe. Man's attitude toward nature is today critically important, simply because we have now acquired a fateful power to alter and destroy nature. But man is a part of nature, and his war against nature is inevitably a war against himself. The rains have become an instrument to bring down from the atmosphere the deadly products of atomic explosions. Water, which is probably our most important natural resource, is now used and reused with incredible recklessness. We in this generation must come to terms with nature. We're challenged as mankind has never been challenged before to prove our maturity and our mastery, not of nature, but of ourselves.
Biologist and environmental activist Rachel Carson speaking in 1963. I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Air.
Time magazine called Rachel Carson one of the most important people of the 20th century and noted, "Before there was an environmental movement, there was one brave woman and her very brave book." In her 1962 book, The Silent Spring, Carson warned the public about the long-term dangers of pesticides. Before that, Carson published books such as The Sea Around Us and The Edge of the Sea, offering readers a view of themselves as just a small part of a vast and glorious environment. Joining us to discuss the life, writings, and legacy of Rachel Carson is Rob Nixon, professor of English at the UW-Madison, and author of a memoir called Dream Birds, The Strange History of the Ostrich in Fashion, Food, and Fortune.
And welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you.
Let's start with that Time magazine assessment of Rachel Carson as one of the most important people of the 20th century. Would you agree with that, and if so, why?
Yes, I would agree with it. It's very interesting that in 1989, Time magazine featured her on the cover and named her as one of the five most important figures of the 20th century. In 1962, when Silent Spring came out, Time magazine panned it as a hysterical outburst.
How times change.
Yeah, how times change, exactly. The Modern Library, a couple of years ago, made a list of the 100 most influential nonfiction books of the 20th century and ranked Silent Spring as number one. So clearly, there is some consensus, at least now, on the book's stature. I think it was a terribly important book for several reasons. First, it was one of those books that not only accrued a vast readership and had a tremendous influence on the way people thought, but it also actually helped change legislation. In that sense, it might be somewhat like Upton Sinclair's The Jungle, about the Chicago stockyards, which helped change the national debate and the laws around slaughterhouses and so forth. In the case of Silent Spring, the laws primarily, I think, started changing in the 1970s, that Silent Spring was the catalyst for a debate that became ever more vigorous through the 60s. And by the time you got to the early 70s, you were having laws like the Endangered Species Act, the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, laws that really changed the lives of every American. And that, I mean, that is one mark of her influence. Another side to this is that people often see her as primarily concerned with the control of pesticides and trying to produce greater awareness and greater control over the toxicity of our environment. But she also really gave tremendous impetus to the idea of ecology itself, that prior to Rachel Carson, most of the thinking was around conservation, and there wasn't the same level of consciousness of what she called the web of life, the whole matrix.
The interconnectedness of things.
The interconnectedness is another way that she describes it. And the way that living creatures are dependent on each other and on the conditions of the environment, and that both the preservationist outlook and indeed just the philosophy of being needed to be connected to that awareness. Perhaps we should also think of her in terms of the climate of the times. And during that post-World War II boom, there was such an atmosphere of technological hubris.
It's so true, yes.
Yeah.
And you could do anything with DDT, you could do anything with wonder drugs.
Right, and so the mastery of nature was a sign of almost illimitable progress for many people at that time, and certainly for most people in government and industry. And the focus, I think, in the culture in the 50s and early 60s when she was writing was very much on the idea of the wizardry of gadgetry, the fact that man's ingenuity was leading him to a position where he would be in control of nature. And just the other day, I saw the 1963 documentary that CBS broadcast some months after Silent Spring appeared. And in it, there was an advocate of the pesticide industry, Robert White Stevens, who was became Carson's nemesis to some extent. And he was arguing that, you know, if we follow Ms. Carson's teachings, as he put it, we'll end up back in the Dark Ages, and that she was an opponent of progress. And somebody else at the time said that in opposing pesticides, she was allowing herself to be a tool of the communist menace. So that gives you a little bit of the flavor of the rhetoric. This wasn't just a debate. This was some serious acrimony there. But in that context, I think you got a sense of how she was thinking against the grain. And Robert White Stevens said she keeps talking about this quaint notion of the balance of nature. He said, you know, we've reached such a position. He said we've reached such a position in the scale of our cities, in the ingenuity of our industry, that we don't need to think about the balance of nature anymore. It's an archaic notion. And she retorted in the film that she wasn't talking at all about the nature of something static, but just the constant rebalancing of nature and natural forces, and that humans needed to temper their hubris with an awareness that the technological changes they made in the environment would come back to impact them.
It's also clear, for example, in the passage I read at the beginning, that she was an eloquent writer, which probably is another reason for her importance, is not only that she had the facts right, but that she could describe it so poetically.
Yes, I absolutely agree with that. And she was really one of the great generalists. And now I think in the last decade particularly, we've seen such an outgrowth of public science writing, and indeed friends in the publishing industry say that that's the single largest growth market of people who have a strong scientific training who can write eloquently. And in those days, the scientific education was clearly inferior, as well as the general body of scientific knowledge. So it took perhaps even more skill, given the character of her audience, to write in an accessible way, but with authority. I wanted to read a quote where she was reflecting on the place of writing and science in her life. Carson said, "The aim of science is to discover and illuminate truth, and that, I take it, is the aim of literature, whether biography or history or fiction. It seems to me, then, that there can be no separate literature of science. If there's poetry in my book about the sea, it is not because I deliberately put it there, but because no one could write truthfully about the sea and leave out the poetry." And I think that says an awful lot about the integral character of her lyricism and her scientific expertise. It was something that she didn't just craft, but she actually believed that an observant relationship to the natural world produced a certain emotional tenor in the work.
Where did she come from as a scientist? What was her background?
Her sense of wonder in the natural world was something that was instilled in her by her mother at an early age. They grew up in rural western Pennsylvania. And then she went to Pennsylvania College for Women. I don't know what became of that, but anyway, that's where she did her undergraduate degree, and she did a joint major in biology and English. So the double interest was there from an early age. Then she went on to Johns Hopkins, where she did an MA in zoology.
Which must have been pretty untraditional for a woman born in 1907.
Very much so, yeah. It was, again, very much against the grain, and she wanted to push on to a PhD and become a marine biologist. That was her dream. But this was 1936. It was the Depression. Her family had fallen on hard times. Her father died. Her sister divorced. She ended up supporting her sister and the two children from the marriage. And then in short succession, she ended up supporting her mother. So she had an entourage of dependents. And the financial circumstances of the family were such that she abandoned the quest of the PhD and went to work for U.S. Fish and Wildlife Services, initially as an aquatic biologist, and then later rose up through the ranks over a period of 15 years to editor-in-chief of all their publications. And I think that in a way this was a fortunate fall. We may have lost a great researcher, but I think a great generalist who can reach a national audience eventually in the millions is a far rarer thing. So the adversity of her graduate career, in a sense, sent her in what may have been a more profitable direction.
What kind of experience did you get working in this fisheries area that I assume it gave her a concrete sense of what was happening in the ocean? And when did she start getting alarmed?
What's interesting is that she had this great romance with the ocean without ever having seen it. It was kind of that she was, I think she was in graduate school before she first saw the ocean.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, it is really remarkable. She went up to Woods Hole, the laboratory up in Massachusetts, one summer and did research there, and that was her first acquaintance with it. But she knew from an early age, she talked about being exposed to the poetry of the sea, John Mansfield and reading Robert Louis Stevenson, people like that, and just feeling the sea in her blood. I'll read a couple of passages where she talks about this. This is Rachel Carson on her early affection for the sea. "It isn't at all surprising that I should have written a book about the sea, because as long as I can remember, it has fascinated me. Even as a child, long before I had ever seen it, I used to imagine what it would look like and what the surf sounded like. Since I grew up in an inland community where we hadn't even a migrating seagull, I had to wait a long time to have my curiosity satisfied. As a matter of fact, it wasn't until I had graduated from college and gone to the famous Marine Biological Laboratory at Woods Hole, Massachusetts, that I saw the ocean. There, too, I began to get my first real understanding of the real sea world. That is, the world as it is known by shorebirds and fishes and beach crabs and all the other creatures that live in the sea or along its edge."
So she is at this point already writing in a way that's different from anyone else writing about the sea.
Yes, one of the interesting things about her writing about the sea, and she wrote a trilogy of books, Under the Sea Wind, The Sea Around Us, and The Edge of the Sea, a sort of oceanic trilogy, was that the sea was seen as such a male domain. We think of, you know, Herman Melville, Joseph Conrad,
Neptune. The male god of the sea.
Yeah, male god of the sea. And so there was some curiosity about this woman who was writing about the sea, and she even recorded in one of her talks that she had received a letter from a man addressed to her, "Dear Sir," and he said, "I know you're a woman, but I can't quite get my head around it."
I think I read somewhere that she did go by the name Ray sometimes.
Ah, yeah, that's
too,
true.
So, that is true. As a nickname. So did she consider herself a sort of trailblazer for women? Did she ally herself with any of the women who were sort of advocating for more access to male-dominated spheres, or did she just sort of do what she did for its own sake?
She definitely had to fight for her space in the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Services. I think there were two women biologists employed by them at that stage. So she was a trailblazer in that regard. At that point, I'm trying to recall what the percentage of tenured women in the sciences was, something like 1% in that vicinity. So I think what was decisive for her was the fact that once The Sea Around Us became such a success, I think it sold 400,000 or 500,000 copies, she was able to leave the service and become an independent writer. And at that point, as a woman writer, I think she had a lot more freedom than she would have had if she'd been working in an institutional context, particularly as a scientist, where the issues of research funding and corporate sponsorship or corporate sensitivity almost certainly would have hampered her, along with the issue, the difficulty of having to demonstrate her credibility as a scientist twice over because she was a woman.
Was The Sea Around Us a work that would, say, like a literary work, be timeless, or is it a work that has some scientific datedness to it today?
I think it is timeless in the power of its evocation. And I really think there are few better writers about the sea. And because Silent Spring was such an epochal work, to some extent people haven't gone back as much to the earlier writing. And I think The Sea Around Us particularly is a magnificent book. Clearly there were gaps in the knowledge, in the scientific knowledge, and so the book would be written differently today. But I still think it stands up largely because of her powers of empathy. And that's an interesting quality in her as a writer, and it's something we mayn't ordinarily associate with non-fiction writers. But I think just as a good fiction writer needs to inhabit a character, she was actually able to inhabit the life forms along the sea's edge, along the sea's bottom, and imagine herself living from their perspective and turning them into characters. And this could be done badly. I mean, you could imagine a sentimental version of this, but I think what was rare in her was this capacity for empathy with other life forms, deepened by genuine scientific knowledge. And there are a couple of passages that I'll read which suggest this. One is from an article that she wrote. It was the first really public experiment with this, what became her voice. It appeared, I think, in 1937. And she'd originally written it for a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service brochure. And the editor there said, this isn't brochure writing. You know, it's too rich, too lyrical. Why don't you send it to the Atlantic Monthly? And she sent this article to the Atlantic Monthly. They snapped it up. It was seen by an editor at Houghton Mifflin, who really liked it, wrote to her and said, why don't you write a book, which became Under the Sea Wind. So her career really took off, starting with this article. I'll just read a few paragraphs from it. The essay is called Under Sea. To sense this world of waters, known to the creatures of the sea, we must shed our human perceptions of length and breadth and time and place, and enter vicariously into a universe of all-pervading water. For the sea's children, nothing is so important as the fluidity of their world. It is water that they breathe, water that brings them food, water through which they see, by filtered sunshine from which first the red rays, then the greens, and finally the purples have been strained, water through which they sense vibrations equivalent to sound. There are comparatively few living things whose shifting pattern of life embraces both land and sea. Such are the creatures of the tide pools among the rocks and of the mudflats sloping away from dune and beach grass to the water's edge. Between low water and the flotsam and jetsam of the high tide mark, land and sea wage a never-ending conflict for possession. The ocean is a place of paradoxes. It is the home of the great white shark, 2,000-pound killer of the seas, and of the 100-foot blue whale, the largest animal that ever lived. It is also the home of living things so small that your two hands might scoop up as many of them as there are stars in the Milky Way. And it is because of the flowering of astronomical numbers of these diminutive plants, known as diatoms, that the surface waters of the ocean are in reality boundless pastures. I think one of the things we see there is not just her lyrical voice, but the fact that she found it very, very early. She was writing, she would have been about 27 when she wrote that. And she had imagined this for a brochure. Now, clearly, this
it definitely doesn't sound like a brochure.
Right, to be handed out at the trailhead. It's a little different from that. So she had her lyrical voice very early. I think what you see by the time you get to Silent Spring, which she started writing when she was about 50, was that she had to develop a polemical voice to blend with that. And what's interesting about the later writing, notably Silent Spring and some of the talks she gave towards the end of her life, what's interesting about that writing is the rhetorical range across which she moves. Whereas the earlier books are more squarely lyrical scientific writing.
Descriptive.
Yeah.
And you seem to sense in her writing, in the passages you read, that sense of wonder.
Yeah. I think that that's a great quality that she had, and something that she possessed all the way through her life, that you felt that she really took energy from the natural world. And when her sister died, and she inherited these two children from her, and then one of these nieces had a child and died, and she inherited that child and looked after this boy and brought him up as her own, Roger, his name was. And he remarked on this, that when he was in her presence in the natural world, she just had this contagious sense of wonder. And I think children have a very sure eye for that. They can tell whether parents or adults are instructing them to be interested in something or are genuinely curious themselves. And I think she had that sense of wonder right the way through.
We're going to sample more of the work of Rachel Carson when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
Because you value the discussion you hear on Wisconsin Public Radio, we're inviting you to visit our website to become a member at any time. Go to WPR.org and click on Membership Information. The Ideas Network is as good as it is because of listeners like you.